Hi there, my name is Kyone. I'll be your server tonight, and my name is Kyone.
Great. I was wondering if I could
Have
get a...
Have you eaten with us here before?
No, but...
Because we do things a little bit differently here. My name is Kyone, by the way.
How different could it be, really?
Well, everything is locally sourced, but it's also individually tailored to you, so I'm going to need you to roll up your sleeves so I can take your blood pressure.
I don't see how this is...
124 over 85. See, that tells us how much salt to put in your food. Now I need to take just a little bit of blood, so make a fist for me.
I don't like getting my blood taken.
Oh, no, it's okay. I'm a licensed phlebotomist. My name is Kyone.
Could you stop saying, ow?
That time I just said it to distract you. Okay, I can type it right here with this device. Oh, negative. Okay, that helps me steer you towards certain menu choices. The last thing I'm going to need from you is a cheek swab.
A what?
Well, we do a very superficial DNA analysis, and it tells us a lot about your likes and dislikes.
Why don't I just tell you what I like instead of...
Let's just let the machine look at this. Your DNA is also a pretty good predictor of how much you'll tip. Looks like 18%. Should we just agree on that right now? Or?
No. Look, no offense, but I think I'll go somewhere else.
You don't like me. You hate me. I don't blame you. I mean, deep down inside, I know I'll never really be good at any of this. You know what? No. Don't you think that my own self-criticism is enough? I mean, you had to reject me, you heartless bastard. You know what? No. You introduced this damn show. My real name is Marie. Not that you care.
And now he's the fussy customer who sent back 3 consecutive buckets at KFC. Colin McEnroe.
Not until they get it right. That's how I feel. I'm not taking that bucket. All right, so we are going to talk about restaurants today. Hopefully not about experiences quite like that one. But we got interested in a few aspects of sort of the changing world of restaurants. So there have been some articles written and even some efforts made to kind of alter the American practice of tipping in restaurants. So that's one of the things we're going to talk about. A little bit later as we head along here, we're also going to talk about sort of the etiquette and changing etiquette, maybe, of who picks up the check and under what circumstances. Used to be, particularly on a date, would be the guy, right? I'm not sure that's the case anymore, but we'll find out. We've got all kinds of experts here. Here in studio with me is Billy Grant. He's the owner of Grant's Restaurant, Brico Trattoria. Also with us in studio, Rand Richards Cooper, a longtime former Bon Appetit writer, now restaurant critic for the New York Times. And joining us by phone a little bit later, Daniel Post-Senig. He is the great-grandson of Emily Post and the author of Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. We're also going to solicit your phone calls as we go along here. 860-275-7266. We'd love to have you call in as we get going here. 860-275-7266. And we're going to start out, though, with Steve DeBlanica. Steve DeBlanica is, among other things, the author of Keep the Change, A Clueless Waiter's Quest to Become the Guru of Gratuities. He maintains the blog Waiterant. There it is. And he's an ex-waiter, as everything that I've just said would suggest. We're going to get you get started with Steve DeBlanica, just to sort of kind of set the stage here. Actually, you know, maybe just to do that, we'll play a little clip from Curb Your Enthusiasm just to illustrate, you know, general levels of confusion about tipping.
What are you going to leave? Let's coordinate the tip here.
Why?
Well, we split the check. We both have the exact same bill. So why don't we leave the same thing so one of us doesn't look like an idiot? What is the big deal if we both leave the same amount?
What do you want to leave? What's your inclination?
$12?
$12?
Yeah.
Good. Put down 12. Write 12 down.
How much are you going to leave? What's your plan here?
I'm encouraging you to leave $12. I think it's a number. There's nothing to be ashamed of on writing $12 under gratuity on your check.
Are you going to leave $12?
All right. So, Steve DeBlanica, first of all, do you think people understand tipping? Do you think American restaurant customers understand what they're supposed to do when it comes to tipping in a restaurant?
Actually, studies have shown that, you know, a significant percentage of people are not aware of what the tipping norm is in this country. That's about between 15 and 20%. So you've got a percentage there who just don't know what they're doing. And I think people are just generally frustrated and perplexed by tipping in general. It generates a lot of anxiety for a lot of people.
What would you like people to know as they approach the whole subject of tipping, as they get ready to tip at the end of the meal? What do they not know about how to apply that 15 to 20% scale that you'd like them to know?
Well, I think one of the first things people should realize is we're not asking you to tip on the tax. There's always some guy who's like, I'm not tipping on the tax. And we're like, we don't expect you to, you know. But I think the most important thing that people need to realize, and a lot of people don't understand this, is that for a waiter in a restaurant, the tip is everything. It's the reason we're there, you know. The restaurant pays a waiter, depending on state, you know, state you're in, it could be as little as $2.25 an hour, a tipping wage, and the tip that you leave represents the bulk of the waiter's income.
And
so if you step them, you've taken a chunk out of their car payment or their rent. That's important.
Are tips based on service, do tips in fact incentivize hard work? I'm going to ask you this, Steve, and then I'm going to open it up to our in-studio guests too. But you start out. Does it really work that way? A tip is
no,
for good service?
Not at all.
Okay.
Anybody who's been a waiter has experienced this dynamic. You've given bad service and gotten a good tip, and given great service and gotten a lousy tip. And you're like, what's going on here? And the studies have shown that diners do not tip to reward the quality of service. They think they do. There's like this mass delusion going on, and the reality is they're tipping for just dozens of reasons. Like they're complying with the social norm. They want to be seen as generous. They're afraid of payback of some sort by the waiter at a future date. You know, things like that. So actually, the service a waiter gives has almost nothing to do with the tip.
Let me open that up to the other people in the room here. Billy Grant, you run a lot of restaurants. Do you agree with that what he's saying, that it's not a reward for good service?
Well, I don't actually agree with that. I don't have direct evidence, but like in our restaurants, I think the servers go above and beyond to try to get that extra tip, and you can literally see them working harder. It's like pushing the guest check average. If they're selling higher priced items, they're going to do better on the tip, you know, so they do a lot of that. So I definitely think it's encouraging for them to push that check and to work harder for that tip.
Although, Rand Cooper, I think part of this also is, I mean, there's sort of like a baseline personality type, you know. There are some of us who are sort of in the kind of 18 to 20% range no matter what. And then if we get really great service, this happened to me last night. I was out. I had got, I thought, very, very nice service. So like 20% wasn't enough. I added a little bit on. I'm thinking people do tip as a reward for good service, but they may start at a different base to begin with.
Well, that's right. And I think that's perhaps one might be comparing apples and oranges. If when one says that there really is no correlation between quality of service and the amount of tip, in other words, a low tip from a good tipper may still be higher than a high tip from a poor tipper. That there may be fundamentally different. You may have a person whose default mode, although he or she could be embarrassed about it if they're pressed, or maybe they just don't know, is to give 11 or 12%. You might have someone else who automatically gives 20, 21, 22%, and who in tipping 19% is expressing his or her relative displeasure. That's still a bigger tip than a tip from someone who got great service but is at heart a poor tipper. So I know that sounds complicated, but I think it is actually statistically complicated. Now, and I will just say on the side, restaurant tipping for me is sort of the one area of tipping in American life that I kind of understand. I know it's expected of me. There are all these other areas, and I know the book, is it Steve, right? Steve's book?
Yeah.
I know that Steve's book is a book about tipping generally. I think most Americans, certainly myself, are totally baffled when it comes to tipping in other areas. Why do we tip person X who performs a service for us and not person Y? And what are the amounts? I understand his book, which I haven't read, is a guide through this, to me, completely bewildering forest of tipping. One reason people may want to hang on to restaurant tipping is at least they think they have that system down. It's less confusing than tipping out there generally.
It's a great point. And as we go along here, if you have your own thoughts and questions and attitudes about tipping, 860-275-7266. We'd love to put you on the air. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. So Steve DeBlanica, one of the proposals that gets made occasionally, and it's sort of similar to what you encounter in Europe, and it's been, I think, was tried recently by a restaurateur in San Diego, is this notion of, you know, well, how about just an 18% service charge? No tipping. Please don't tip. Don't leave anything more than that. I think the guy in San Diego also wanted to be able to split it up with some of the people who don't, some of the other restaurant workers who are not eligible for tips, particularly. I think even.
Yeah,
even,
this is the guy who went out of business.
Well, okay. Could have been for other reasons.
This comes up. It's a perennial topic. And per se, for example, they got rid of tips. And very fancy restaurant in New York, and they decided to pay their waiters a salary. They gave them health care. They gave them benefits. They gave them sick time. It's a beautiful thing. They were able to do that because of the prices they charge, okay? I don't see how that can be scaled down to mom-and-pop restaurants. The other thing is, if you look at there's a scam that goes on at weddings, okay? You go in. I just got married, so I understand this completely. You leave a $2,000 tip, and then you find out that the servers were paid $15 an hour. So a lot of that tip went to the people who didn't serve the actual customers at the table. So my worry about when they come out with the flat rate and pay waiters' salary or distribute money from that pool is how, since I'm cynical, is that amount going to be distributed equitably? In my experience in restaurants, and when you look at all the lawsuits that are filed against people who rob tips from waiters, is that very often tips are stolen. They're stolen in the system that we have now. You know, I worry if we went into a system like that where they decide what the waiter's going to get paid, flat rate perhaps, is that it will be lower than what the waiter could make hustling tips as it is now.
Let me talk to Billy Grant about this. Obviously, you own three restaurants. You supervise a lot of waiters. Our sense in talking to you beforehand was not too crazy about the idea of maybe going to an 18% service charge that has no flexibility in it.
Right. Well, the first point about a restaurant like Per Se, its size and its quality and its price, very few restaurants have the luxury of being that consistently booked with, you know, 2-month wait or whatever it is. So that money's like guaranteed there every night. And I also believe that, you know, at that level of excellence, they're hiring people that are self-motivated. Mm. So they're not having people who are part-time students or part-time, you know, a realtor or part-time mom. So that's, I think, another issue. Mm-hmm. On the catering end of things, like at least for us, I definitely agree that other people do that and they're, you know, stealing the tip here or there or not distributing it properly. For us, when we go out, we actually, on our catering, we don't have tipping on catering. So any off-premise events, a wedding, there's no gratuity involved. We just have a rate per each server, so that rate goes directly to that server. You know, $25 an hour goes right to the server, so there is no tipping. So on a wedding, because it is very confusing and you're talking about a very large chunk. Mm. So that's how we handle that.
But another part of this is you really want your staff to be working hard to get a bigger tip, right? You want, in terms of delivery of service.
100%. And I definitely think that it helps motivate the people. I think the flat rate tip creates laziness. I don't want to say that I see that in our own catering, but I get it because I can see it. Because they're guaranteed that $25 an hour on the catering job. Of course they have to work hard because we're right there next to them, but it definitely creates laziness, I feel.
Rand, what do you think about this?
Well, to put my cards on the table, I'm agnostic on the issue of the change. One of the reasons is that from the diner's point of view, let's say you're gonna put an 18% service charge on. Well, I tip 18%, so I mean it's going to be a wash for me just in terms of money. So my interest in it lies in what it will do to the way restaurants work, the way restaurants run. I will add one asterisk. There's a very large class of restaurants, not like Billy's and not like Thomas Keller's, that are inexpensive family restaurants. I take my 7-year-old daughter regularly to a Friendly's-like family restaurant. I won't name it. And we sit there for a couple of hours, and we ring up a bill of $19. Mm. Now, the restaurant is staffed by waiters and by servers who clearly are not living opulently. They're probably really scratching to get by. They're paid a low wage. And I usually will leave $25, so a $6 tip, that's like a 32% tip because, you know, the amounts of money are so small. I don't know what happens to those people if you implement a flat rate that's well below what a generous tip would be. So there's that issue. But I will say that for those who are making the case for the switch, and a question I'd put to Billy and other, and I have put to other restaurant owners, does it not sometimes seem a little paradoxical that, say, a line cook who's slaving away in the heat of the kitchen to actually make the meal ends up making roughly a third of what the person who hands the dish over to the customer? And I think there's a perception of sort of a fundamental structural asymmetry or even injustice in that. That's part of the reason people want to go to a system that would seem to recognize the valued contributions of all members of the team, including those who are actually making the food. So I think that's a big question. It's one I've put to a number of restaurant owners, and I've heard what they say, but, you know, it's one of the reasons that we're talking about this.
Yeah, it's totally like an oxymoron, because even when I was a young chef, I wasn't doing it for the money. I'm doing it for the passion, for the love of food. Not to say that a lot of servers, hopefully especially the ones at the restaurants that we have, are doing it because they love serving or they like working with the public or for people. For instance, my two children, both in college, both wanted to be in the front of the house because the tip, the money per hour, is better with the tip than it is in the back of the house.
Let me grab a call here from Amanda. Let me just also sort of reset here. Our topic right now is sort of about tipping, whether the current rules of tipping make sense, whether there's a better way to do it. We haven't mentioned this yet, but, I mean, Rand obviously lived in Europe for a long time. Anybody who goes to Europe knows it is different over there. There is more of a sort of service charge, no tip attitude. Of course, you're free to leave a few extra euros there as you go along. With us, Steve Dublonica. He's the author of Keep the Change, A Clueless Waiter's Quest to Become the Guru of Gratuities. He maintains the blog Waiter Rant. He's an ex-waiter. Billy Grant's the owner of Grant's Restaurant Brico and Brico Trattoria. Rand Cooper with us, a longtime Bon Appetit writer, now a restaurant critic at the New York Times. And Amanda, you're on the line from Hartford. Hi, Amanda. Oops. She's not there. Either that or we've got her on the wrong line here. Let's while we're sorting out where Amanda is, and our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. We have a lot of calls coming in here. But let me just go to that question, Rand, and I will sort of fire it back to you. You lived in Europe a long time. You lived in Germany a long time. It is different over there. You don't do the kind of tipping that we do here in America. Does it result in lackadaisical service?
There was an article in the New York Times about a month ago, sort of amusing, about how the Chamber of Commerce or whatever its equivalent is in Paris is trying to give, in effect, remedial lessons in politeness to Parisian servers, because there's a fairly well documented record of perhaps not always being optimally civil to guests, particularly foreign guests. So it's not – there's certainly a reputation. And when I spoke 2 days ago with a European restaurant owner friend of mine, he's European, but he owns a restaurant here in this area, and for him, it's absolutely clearly the case that service in this country is better than its counterpart in Europe, because there isn't a sort of careless attitude. The article about Parisian waiters said that the default — one witty person noted that the default attitude of a waiter at a Parisian brasserie is to the customer is, "Don't bother me, I'm doing my job." And, you know, the amusing paradox in that is very clear to Americans. But, you know, that said, I lived in Germany for 6 years. I traveled widely in Europe, and I generally got very, very good service. And I also got service of a professional – and this opens up a big topic, the topic of professionalism in this career. Often you would get a kind of professional service that you don't get here. I'd be happy to unpack what that means to me as a diner.
Actually, you know what? Let's hold that and take a break. Give the callers a chance to get up here on the board here. I've told you who's here. We'd love to hear from you as well. We'll take a little break. We'll come back with that idea of professionalizing waiter service.
Now her paycheck's low. She does the work of two, at least. When something's wrong, folks blame you know who. And then they say, come on now, where's your smile? While the owner's getting richer all the while. Please tip your waitress, she's working hard for you. She'll walk a few miles more before she's through. She's got bills to pay and food to buy like you. Please tip your waitress, cause she's working hard for you. Please tip your waitress, cause she's working hard for you.
How does the service you receive at a restaurant affect the tip that you leave a server?
I always leave 15% no matter what the service, but if there's good service, then I leave even more.
Now, waiters and waitresses work extremely hard, and they get paid nothing. And I feel very, like, for instance, like we went out to eat yesterday, you know, about a $5 meal for each of us, and I gave the young lady $4. She was just a very nice person.
I tip 20%, but no, if they don't deserve it, I'll normally do at least 10%.
Pretty minimal, actually. The service has to be really bad for me to not tip.
I always leave 27% tips. 27% is minimum. And if they're extra nice, 37%.
I'm not sure how genuine that last one was, but those are voices from the streets.
You need that guy at your restaurant.
Right,
probably.
Exactly. Voices from the streets gathered by Garrett Connolly, our intern. We are talking about service in restaurants, about tipping in restaurants as we go along here also. We're going to get into other aspects of restaurant etiquette. But right now we're on tips. And let me see if I can grab a call here. Steve Dublonica is back with us over there, I think. And so here's Amanda from Hartford, as promised before. Hi, Amanda. That's not Amanda. All right, so I'm going to try another line and just see what happens. Here's Hampton from New Haven. Hi, Hampton. You're on the air.
I try to be a good tipper in a restaurant, about 20 to 25%. But I also wanted to point out it was interesting living in Manhattan where we in a regular building, but you have doormen. At Christmas time, you get notifications from all the doormen, from the post office employees, from the building super. And I would get 10 notices from people I'd never heard of introducing themselves, asking for tips at Christmas time. And it's pretty much standard fare. And I think that was an interesting way to look at tipping overall because a lot of their incomes were based on this Christmas tips for the year.
You know, absolutely. You didn't even have to go to New York for that. I lived in a building here in Hartford, not too far from where we're sitting right now, where exactly that happened. And that sort of gets back to Rand's observation that that nobody knows how much to tip anybody else in any other circumstance. It's only in restaurants where we have this 15 to 20% bracket that people at least understand. Rand, I want to get back to what you were saying before, this whole notion of the waiter as a professional, because I think that sort of affects our whole attitude about whether the waiter gets paid some kind of standard thing or whether the waiter gets tipped.
Right. One of the articles that you sent along by one of the would-be reformers who said, I can hear your objection. How can servers be motivated to do a good job without tips? And the writer answered his own question by saying, servers are motivated to do a good job in the same way everyone else is. They want to keep their jobs. They want to get a raise. They want to be successful and see themselves as professionals and take pride in their work. Now, I don't think that simply by changing the tip structure and installing a flat 18% service charge, you are going to transform table service into a profession. A profession means a number of things, and certainly in Europe where I live for a number of years, it means that when you finish school and probably a trade school, if you had, for instance, if you were going to be a waiter or have another service type job, you had an apprenticeship. The apprenticeship would train you for a couple of years. And then you would have an initial job under a mentor. You had the expectation that you were going to spend your entire career in this profession. Your knowledge base was great. You built up a kind of competence in the same way that our real professionals do here, whether they're doctors, lawyers, or whatever. Most, as Billy said when we were off the air, that the majority of his waiters are people who in 5 years are going to be doing something different. It's a transient population. That's the antithesis of a profession. And I'll just finish by saying that from the diner's point of view, it's quite rare, despite the enthusiasm, the eagerness to help, and the many attractive qualities of the people who wait on tables in this market, it's relatively rare for me to come away saying or writing in a review, this was truly professional service. It wasn't. It was enthusiastic. It was eager. It was pleasant. It was nice. It was friendly. But it was not professional.
What would make it professional?
Well, first of all, you would not do something like when a diner asks you whether there was sage included in that dish, say, shrug and say, "You got me." You would know the menu. You would know the ingredients of dishes. You would not, for instance, if asked what went into something, say, "Let me go get the menu," and then bring the menu over and read it verbatim to the person. You would know something about a wine list, especially if you were, for instance, a server at a pricey vineyard restaurant, and you were asked whether St. Croix was a grape varietal or a place denomination or what exactly. You wouldn't say, "Gee, you know what? I don't know." And even if you didn't know, you would quickly go and find out. So there is a knowledge base that one of the hallmarks of a profession is that you have a specific knowledge base that you've mastered.
Billy Grant is nodding his head and wagging his finger, indicating to me he has something to say about this.
Yeah, I remember having the first meal I had in New York City was at Le Cirque, and it was a wedding gift shortly after I got married. We had placed an order, and my wife at the time had ordered a ravioli, and she had also ordered a lobster risotto as a second course, and the waiter stopped her and said that was double starch and that she should change her order. And, you know, that it's like a dying breed, that level of professionalism.
Right, and there's often waiters here are urged to compensate with excessive friendliness, and while that can be endearing, I was at a restaurant just the other day, and I was having a conversation with my friend. And the waitress, the server, went by, and she happened to hear a word that I used. And she stopped, and smilingly she interrupted, and she said, "Oh," and she said the word. "That's a real SAT word." Now, this was not Friendly's. This was a pretty expensive restaurant. So there's also a professional demeanor. There's professional stance, literally physical stance at your table. There's a way in which you change the courses. You change the cutlery when you do, when you don't. You know, all of it. It's a very big package.
I want to hear Steve Dublanica on all this. Hi, Steve. Are you still listening?
I'm still here.
Yeah, so react a little bit to this, to the whole idea of what it would mean to be a professional and be treated like a professional.
Well, I think one of the problems is that waiting tables tends to be a transitory business for most people in this country. Unlike in Europe, where there's an apprenticeship and there's training, this is very often, you know, actors, writers, kids in school, and they don't have much of an investment into learning how to be a top-notch waiter. And that's why, you know, you go to places like Per Se or the French Laundry, and that's people who are really at the top of their game. That is not what most American diners are going to experience. But I think one of the things that would help improve the professionalism of waiters is if waiters were treated more like regular workers. I think one of the biggest problems that waiters face is that the vast majority of them don't have health care. The vast majority of them don't get vacation time, and the vast majority of them don't even get sick time. There's an old adage, unless you're actively bleeding out, you better come to work, you know? And so that's part of it, you know, not to be treated so poorly by ownership. That happens. And also that waiters are, and I write about this in my first book extensively, are treated very badly by the dining public. You know, we hear about, you know, issues with waiters saying things that aren't appropriate, and they are. But if I could tell you some of the horror stories that I went through, you know, in my 9.5 years of waiting tables, you know, waiters are treated like serfs.
And, you know, that actually gets to sort of one of the differences between America and Europe, because I think one of the mistakes Americans make in European cities sometimes is waiters do expect to be treated differently in Europe. And we're very used to sort of very casual interactions with our waiters. When you walk into a restaurant in Paris, the man there expects to be addressed as monsieur. He expects to be sort of greeted as the professional he considers himself to be. He's not working for tips, as you said. He's doing his job, and he's a professional. He expects to be treated a certain way. And Americans, I mean, we hope Americans would never be rude to anybody in any situation, including the one Steve's talking about. But in Europe, you can seem rude, not meaning to be, just because you have sort of different expectations for that interaction. Let's grab a call here from Henry in Groton. Hi, Henry.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm enjoying the conversation, and I have many thoughts. I'm a professional waiter myself, currently not employed in the business, but anyway, plenty of experience. And it's fascinating. The tipping situation, first of all, I mean, it really ought to be viewed as, from a waiter's point of view, as your immediate feedback. Do you know that you did a good job or not? That's the number you're looking for. I mean, I don't know how 18% became the norm. I think it started 15 or so years ago. It used to be 15. But there's occasions where a customer may, now not often, but they may forget, or they may undertip from some ignorance. But if you send a message by tipping 5 or 10% that you were really unhappy with your experience, you know, 15 ought to be the baseline. And above that, as a waiter, the goal is 20% and above. Now, with the 15% base, I've always thought that a pooling house, very unpopular topic, but a pooling house with the right team of mature professionals can really thrive. If you have a baseline of 15% of your sales taken off and shared with everybody else, and then whatever you make above that, you keep. I think is an idea that I'd like some of your guests to speak to.
Oh, yeah, it's a great topic and a great angle on this. I'll start with Billy. What about that whole idea? Pooling the baseline, keep the extra.
You know, the pooling thing only works, like he said, if you have the right team in place. It's like a football team. If you have the right players at the right time, you know, you can win the championship, but it really takes the right team. Otherwise, I think it promotes laziness.
Well, and also it can, as I know too well, promote resentments. When I was in college, I spent my summers waiting tables at Chuck's Steakhouse, and most of the rest of the staff were full-timers. They were 29, 30-year-old people who'd been doing this for 6 or 7 years. They were better waiters than I. We had a tip pooling structure, and it was surely the case that they felt a little bit aggrieved that they were going to share tips with me because I was clearly an inferior waiter. So I think that's a problem. What I feel about pooling and sharing, by the way, most restaurants, yours included, obviously have some scheme of whereby servers share some amount of their tips with runners, with bussers, with bar staff. I think that way that works varies from place to place, but it's still relative to what the waiters make, kind of a semi-pittance. And I do keep coming back to the notion that the team that's required to put this whole machine together, is there's a gross inequity, and the people who just happen to have interpersonal skills are articulate, are going to make two or three times the amount of the people who are making the food. Now, I asked a good friend of mine who's a restaurant owner about that because it seemed to me that it's unfair and that you might want to ameliorate that a little bit. And, boy, he had a whole set of answers. He was vociferous about not changing the system. And one of them was that, you know what, my wait staff, they are my diplomats. They are my point of contact with the public. I can control what's coming out of the kitchen. I can control my line cooks and oversee that. But I can't control what's going on table after table. That each one of those persons is making or breaking my restaurant in encounter after encounter. That was one of about 5 points that he made in defense of the current system.
And remember that not everybody in the back of the house works well with the public. That's a gift in its own self, where you have very talented people in the back of the house that just, aren't as comfortable at the table with the public.
Right, but why are their talents worthless?
Steve, there's a third rail, which I wasn't even sure I was going to bring up, but I think I'm going to bring it up, that we haven't talked about here. And that is there are certain groups, certain ethnic groups, racial groups, visiting groups. I mean, actually, I think in some of our earlier conversations, Rand was saying, American waiters don't want to wait on Europeans because they know that Europeans don't have the American attitude towards tipping. But there are other prejudices that exist among serving staffs in restaurants. And I know of people who've worked as hostesses who've had waiters say, do not ever seat people from racial or ethnic or whatever group X in my area because they don't tip well, which seems to me grotesquely unfair in a whole bunch of different ways and even suggests that people from a self-perpetuating cycle, that people from racial group or ethnic group X don't get good service because the waiters have already decided that particular group of people don't tip well. And in some ways, to me, that's another argument for the 18% experiment.
Well, One of the dirty secrets about the restaurant business is that waiters have a prejudice against African Americans as customers. Okay, and it was not uncommon for me to hear, "I don't want that table, the table of African Americans." Walk down. I would hear this from black waiters.
Mm-hmm.
Say, "I don't want that table." And when I was writing my book, Keep the Change, it always bothered me. I was a waiter I was like, oh, you know, this sounds racist. This sounds like, you know, just ridiculous nonsense. And then I wish you had Mike Lynn on today. He did a wonderful study about this, and he crunched the numbers. And he found out that on average, not that every African-American is a bad tipper, but on average, African-Americans tip 3% less than whites. And so there is some reality in the stereotype. Now, there's a bunch of other stereotypes, like women are bad tippers, or gay people are great tippers. Now, I can tell you that's, you know, that's not necessarily true. But there was that statistical piece. You know, people have argued against it, but it's there.
Yeah.
And it's a very uncomfortable number. And I think one of the things that Mike Lynn did in his study was he was trying to figure out why this happened, you know. And he noticed that African Americans had a lower knowledge of what a standard tip should be than their Caucasian counterparts. So he said, okay, well, maybe there'll be some kind of education, you know, pamphlets that will teach people this is the norm. And when they did that, one third of the African Americans in the study improved their tipping habits, and they became, you know, within the norm. Two-thirds didn't budge.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Mike, why didn't they budge? And he says, I have no clue. I only know the number is there. So there is something with the African-American experience in restaurants that is going on that we have not yet identified that is at the root of this. And it could also, I've also said, I worked in white tablecloth restaurants for years. And African Americans were by far the most underrepresented group of patrons in the restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's going on? About what's going on with that?
Yeah.
So yeah, and that's a very uncomfortable topic, and it's something that I always said in my book is it needs to be discussed.
Well, we've just opened that particular can of worms. We're also going to grab a break here. We need to devote some of the show today. We promised that we would devote some of the show to also some other changing norms, especially who picks up the check, which I think is getting more and more complicated for reasons that we'll detail in the next segment.
You're driving around in the great big car, and everything's looking all right so far, but you can't pay the bill with a bigger cigar. Who's gonna pay the check?
Today's show was prepared and served by Betsy Kaplan, with a balsamic reduction of Patrick Scahill and a puree of fava beans and me. Our interns are Garrett Connolly and Jonathan Scranton. The part of Bill Curry was played by Wolfgang Puck. On tomorrow's show, The Nose says, on Wiener, on Filner, on Spitzer, goodbye to our favorite pervy political reindeer. And now, back to Colin.
How do you decide who will pick up the bill at a restaurant?
If I'm with a friend, I like to pick up the bill. Yeah, I feel good about it. But he'll hear from me, or she'll hear from me for about a week, and I'll probably be over their house every day around supper time.
I don't know. If I invite somebody, I'm paying. If it's a group, hey, you split it evenly.
If that isn't a challenge.
I am the most generous man you'll ever meet, and I like to pick up the check. I like to pick up the check of the person sitting next to me, too.
I always kind of assume that it's me.
All right, so when we have questions like this, we reach out invariably to the Emily Post Institute, and we're going to do that in just a second. But one of the things that intrigued us, I think, is, you know, in a lot of these situations, particularly dating situations early in the dating process, I think there's still this pretty much old school idea. I could be wrong about this, but I think some people have the old school idea. Still, the man should pick up the check. Obviously, there are some economic currents that even kind of run against this right now. Certainly, post-2008, women seem to be more employable than men. So you sort of wonder about that. So we also wonder, just in the rules, picking up checks, splitting checks, how does this all get worked out? How does it get figured out? Joining us right now, I said earlier in the show it would be Daniel Post sending. I was wrong. It's Lizzie Post. As long as it's a post, we know we're in very good hands. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. So give us a thumbnail on this. How should it work?
Generally, the sort of rule of thumb on it is that if you've done the inviting, then you're kind of doing the paying, and that's the general thought on the matter. But a lot of people say, okay, well, that's fine, but, you know, I get asked on a lot of dates, and it makes me uncomfortable to have someone take me out on the first date. I'd rather, you know, split the bill. And that's fine. You just want to bring that up at some point before the bill shows up at the end of the night. That way everyone knows what's going on and what's going to be expected.
You know, Steve Dublanica, a waiter can play a little bit of a role here sometimes. Waiters often do deliver the bill to the guy. What's your overall policy about that?
If it was a couple eating, I would drop the check in the middle.
Yeah.
Way to go.
I'm not fighting for or against women's lip. I just don't want any trouble. I'm just like, let me put it right there, and you two fight it out. I think what's good is when you have a large party, when the host says, "I will take the check," like at the beginning of the meal, he says, "You know, because sometimes you have that situation where everyone wants to pay."
Yeah.
You know, so it's good if you have a larger group to identify yourself as the pay, and I know who to butter up that.
go ahead, Lizzie.
No, I was just going to say that in business situations, or often when it is a larger group like that, we say the best thing to do as the host, if you are comfortable picking up the tab, or if you are picking up the tab, to actually even go to the waiter or waitress ahead of time when you're making the reservation and explain that. Or when you first get into the restaurant, say, you know, I don't want the bill coming to the table. You know, I'll come and see you when we're finished, and we'll handle the bill that way. And it's just nice that way that the bill doesn't even become something anyone sees and can ask to fight over. It's just taken care of. It's done. It's discreet.
Billy Grant, you've owned restaurants for a number of years. Are there any shifts going on? Do you see any shifts? Is it less likely to be sort of the old school?
Yeah, and what we're seeing mostly is the splitting, and the splitting of checks is okay on a smaller basis, you know, two people, four people is fine. But what is very difficult and starting to happen more
seven
and more
checks.
Is seven, eight, nine checks. And not only is it very difficult to do that, but it's taken time away from the other guests too. So that's definitely in the behind the scenes kind of an issue for happening now.
And that's like three people, four people, five people hand you their cards, their credit cards,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, because it takes a little time to process.
So what's the maximum that's sort of tolerable?
Well, the staff always wants to say we need to put a limit, and me, I always say, well, we're gonna do what they want us to do. So if we have to split it 10 ways, we're splitting it, and we'll get the manager to help. Mm-hmm. We want to do that for them, but it definitely, when you're spitting it more than twice, it starts to slow you down.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is it easier if the party coming in, let's say it is that table of 10 and let's put them in groups of three and one group of four, is it easier if they say, you know, can you put us four, like separate the check from the beginning, or is that just as much work?
No, that helps when they separate the check from the beginning. But
from the beginning.
Quite often they don't do that.
Okay. We always do recommend that people do that. If they're going to do it, we say tell them at the beginning. That way they're not trying to figure out who had what meal and what gets grouped on what card.
You know, Lizzie, another thing that's happening, obviously, a lot of people going on dates that are Match.com dates, that are first dates out of some dating service, chemistry, whatever. I don't know if the rules are any different there, but it almost seems as though that even introducing that as part of your first conversation, well, we're going on a date, but we're going to split the check, or we're going on a date, but I intend to pay. It seems like a very awkward thing to be saying very early in that process.
It does, and I think you can kind of handle it two ways. A lot of people kind of, when it comes to the online dating, they have their set MO for what they're comfortable with for a first date. Like they say, I'd love to meet you for coffee, and often they'll get their own coffee. You know, you both go up, or you know, a lot of coffee houses, you know, you're not having a waitress come over, that sort of a thing. But the other way I've had friends handle it is that they say, I would like to take you out, as opposed to let's meet up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit more formal, so sometimes it's not the best thing to hear on a first date, but or that first get to know you meeting. But it at least lets someone know I would like to take you out. That's a way that they can say like I would like to take care of this for the evening. And with online dating, you often know that first date, it really is just to see if there is any in-person chemistry.
You know, while we've got all these experts here, there's one other area I wanted to get into, and I'm going to start out with Rand because I know what his feelings about this are going to be. But Garrett, our intern, brought this up earlier today, that he was working in a 5-star restaurant where so many people asked for the wireless code, the online code, because they had their tablet there,
right.
They had a small laptop there, they wanted to do something with their phone. We've also got this world of people who are in love with Instagram and want to take pictures of their food. There's some high-end restaurants that have just banned that practice because they – they feel it so indecorous and unsuitable. I'm going to start out with Rand Cooper on this because you're such a reliable Luddite about this. But give me your sense about the whole idea of these electronic devices in the restaurant.
I guess I am a Luddite. I'm aware that certainly for restaurant reviewers, having pictures of your of the food you ate afterward can be helpful when it comes to remembering what you ate. Perhaps there's something that you forgot to note mentally. And I never did this until recently. I had dinner out with a friend, and he's a real device monkey, and so he took pictures of everything, and it was very helpful for me to have 9 pictures of what we ate afterward. But if it gets to the point, and there was an article in the Times about this a few months back, when it gets to the point where it really seems like it's a photo op all around you, and people are snapping pictures everywhere, that's distracting. Now, for me to see someone talking on his or her cell phone during a meal, as you know, Colin, I really object to that. Now, it's mysteriously distressing because here you are surrounded in a room with people talking all over the place. Conversation is the norm for restaurants. Why should it bother you that someone's on a cell phone? Well, these are sort of there are symbolic codes that are involved in this. And
well, Lizzie can tell you why does it bother Rand that people are talking on cell phones, even if they would otherwise just be talking anyway?
A lot of the time, it has to do with the fact that there's and this is a little bit weird. I'm with him on this. Is that you're hearing one half of the conversation, and you're not. It's not like you're trying to eavesdrop, but you are. There is. It's like not. It doesn't seem natural to the situation. If you know what I mean, it's
we haven't yet cognitively normalized the odd routine of a one-sided conversation. It hasn't yet become part of the acceptable ambient background. It strikes a discordant note. The other thing is, you think, oh, they're probably doing business, and if we're in a place of pleasure, we do not want to be reminded visually in any other way that, oh, someone's probably, you know, doing business over there. Somehow, in an obscure way, that impedes upon your ability to relax.
Well, now, Billy Grant believes the customer is right 99% of the time. But yeah, you've got to negotiate this thing, too, because some of your customers may not be too happy that there's somebody flashing around with an iPad next to them, or that there's somebody, you know, just doing electronic stuff when they're trying to have a high-end meal.
Right. I'm with Rand, but sadly, this has become the world we live in. I mean, my children in college, they're texting under the table as, you know, our family's celebrating a birthday dinner at, you know, a hibachi place. So it's the next generation, you know, it's really going to be an issue. Interesting, because you're at a table with 4 people and they're all texting, taking photos, doing Instagram.
And it's sad because since one of the purposes of a restaurant is conversation,
right.
You see a couple and they're both sitting there with their devices locked in their separate worlds. I sit there and I spiritually deflate.
If I go into Grant's or Brico and say, what's the wireless code, is there an answer to that question?
Yeah, there will be. I don't have it, but there will be.
What about that, Lizzie, that whole idea of going in there? And I mean, a lot of people, it's not just phones these days. It's a tablet or it's something like that. And they want the wireless code. They want to be able to look something up at the table.
Right. I think there's no problem in asking for it, but don't be surprised if the restaurant says, I'm sorry, we don't give it out, or we don't have one, you know, for public use. I think that's important to recognize. It's not every establishment that you walk into's responsibility to provide you with Wi-Fi. And if it is, if we decide to go in that direction, expect the prices of the food to go up. I think it's really one of those things where we like to say, you know, take your photograph and then post it later, or take your photograph or check in on Foursquare or whatever it is and then put your phone away. Because anytime you've got that phone out, I mean, the focus starts to turn to it. And sure, it's fun when the conversation becomes something of a, you know, a debate or something, you decide to settle it by searching it on Google, whatever it is. But at the same time, you don't want the entire meal or the entire interaction between you to be with this device being a part of it. We need to focus on the people that we're with, and it is okay for us to detach for a minute or an hour and a half and allow that to happen.
All right, Lizzie Post, great answer. We got to stop there. Thanks to Rand Richards Cooper, to Billy Grant, to Steve Dublonica, to Lizzie Post, and we'll be back tomorrow with The Nose. Not a request, it's all command. So tip the band, tip the band. This is hard work and we do it well. That's the story that we're here to tell. It's not a request, it's all command. So tip the band, tip the band. I'm Kyone Wolf. Anything else I can get for you today?
No, I'm all set.
All right, well, you can go f*** yourself, and if you ever come to this f***ing restaurant again, I'll kill you. Ugh, no tip? That guy is such a f***ing jerk.